Bart. Okay. Lisa, go ahead and ask about... can our board and staff hear, see and hear, and if so, can we put thumbs up? Great. Can members of the public see and hear? And have no faces, so I'm going to assume they can. This meeting is being recorded. Once President Brooks asks me to call the roll, indicate you are here, as well as give permission to record by verbally stating here, permission to record. I call the October 5th, 2021 Committee of the Whole meeting of my Park District to order. Lisa, please call the roll and note the time. Great, it's 7:01. Member Boren?
Yes, permission to record.
Member Covey?
Yes, permission to record.
Member Schneider?
Yes, permission to record.
Member Stain?
Yes, permission to record.
Chair Brooks?
Yes, permission to record. It's our practice not to address questions at this time. However, we will take comments under advisement. Is there anyone who would like to make a verbal comment? If so, please limit comments to 3 minutes per person.
I see no one, Lisa.
Okay, ditto. Then we will move to the first item on the agenda, discussion on Watts operations for the 2021-22 season. Lisa Shepherd, Bobby, and Adam will lead the discussion. Go ahead.
All right, I'm going to throw it over to Bobby and Adam.
Evening, everybody. Hopefully everybody can see the presentation. So tonight we're going to be talking about Watts pricing and operating plan for this upcoming season, which starts the day after Thanksgiving. So over the last 18 months, we've learned a lot about COVID and operating facilities in these difficult times. So we're still obviously in the midst of a pandemic, and heading into the Watts season, we have to kind of maintain a similar plan to what we've done at the beach and the ice rink in the past. So we developed three main options to look at when looking at Watts for this season. The first was to do season passes only. This is very similar to what we did last year. We would look at it without doing reservations or time slots for open skate. Remember last year, we were very limited. I think we had 25 on each space at one time. That was during the kind of the peak of the pandemic last year. And then it freed up as we went on. So we did see quite a surge for passes, as there was not a lot to do last winter. The second option was to do season passes 7 days per week. Would add a daily admission option Monday through Thursday. This is based off the beach model that we successfully did this summer. We have found that the busiest days at the rink are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, so we would limit the option for pass holders to those days. This is what staff recommend. And the third option was to return to regular COVID operations, or regular operations pre-COVID. So what we've learned about passes and our pricing strategy for the beach, we want to try to maximize value of the pass. How we do this is by aggressive pricing. We do value for money, exclusive access to guest passes, discounts on those guest passes, and then the pass holder appreciation events, which were so successful last year at the ice rink, and we also had a beach. Why do we want to do this? Well, revenue is less impacted by weather. These outdoor facilities, as we know, all depend on how good or bad the weather is during them. Pass holders visit more often, but they also come for a shorter period of time. They also are more invested in the operation. They tend to take care of it. They put the trash away. They tend to clean up after themselves, and also builds a sense of community. And we saw that last year. Watts really was the place to be. Those Friday night skates, people loved it. It really is the only thing you can do in town with the community. This will limit the burden on taxpayers. As we know, Watts is subsidized by the taxpayer every year. And we also are looking to simplify the fee structure, like we did with the beach, make it simple, easy to understand, reduce the barriers for people for buying the passes. And we also want to increase access by offering the daily fees Monday through Thursday. Pass it to Adam, who can talk about the financials from the last couple of years.
So this shows last season pass kind of breakdown, skating and hockey passes, the guest passes for residents and non-residents. So we did a 50% markup for non-residents last year over each pass option. So if you wanted to skate, you had to buy a skating pass. If you wanted to play hockey, you had to have a hockey pass. We also required reservations. for all time slots. Number of sold, you kind of see where that was, and then the rest. Done historically, kind of expected, as Bobby alluded to, not a lot going on last winter, so people were eager to get out, even somewhere to the beach for one weekend or just over winter break, or family in town for Thanksgiving, whatever it might be. This for me, really no more than 300 passes. Daily financials, so this looks at our daily admission comparison. So this was pre-COVID in 2019-20. We brought in roughly under 40,000 in total revenue in skating and hockey daily admission. We had seen an upward trend, but this is so dependent on weather. If we have a bad weather winter where it's really snowy or really cold, just not ideal skating, you kind of see a dip. We've had some good weather the last few seasons. So our recommendation, looking at our season schedule, this comparison of last year, we historically open the day after Thanksgiving. We try to make it through the end of February, weather permitting, depends on the year. Last few seasons, we've stayed open longer. We've had years we closed early February, so it just kind of depends on the weather. Hours of operation have fluctuated a little bit, but they've been pretty consistently at kind of the 12 to 11 p.m. Range Monday through Thursday, and then Friday we'll stay open a little bit later, and Saturday and Sunday. These are all based around if we have any private rentals, hockey groups, etc. So those are still in line. Something we did get feedback from the Watts Advisory Group last week was to do some tot skates, so we're going to look to add those a few days a week earlier than that 12. So we'll explore those options and try to get the different preschoolers an opportunity to get on ice or really get to the nap. Season passes, so the biggest difference this year we're looking at doing is an all-access pass. Operationally, this simplifies the process a lot more for our cashiers, our Zamboni, and our members on duty. Trying to differentiate who's there for hockey versus skating can get complicated. So we wanted to simplify it similar to the beach. Just want to keep that as streamlined as possible, increase access as much as possible. So $60 residents, and then non-residents would be $120, so 100% markup for non-residents. Residents will go on sale the 14th of this month, the 15th. Non-residents will have to wait until November 1st. So you can see there's not a significant increase over last year's open skate. Then daily admission, we didn't offer last year, but we're looking at a resident of $12 and $17 for non-residents, and that'll all be online in advance via ticket. As far as, go ahead.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but we'll only do dailies, weekends, Monday through Thursday, correct?
Correct. Yep. So only Monday through Thursday will we have those daily admissions. So we look at some different revenue models. So comparison of what we did last year. So we see the yellow where we fell revenue-wise, and then kind of did a best, mid, and worst case scenario. Anybody under the age of 3 is free, and then residents over 65 are free. Non-residents will pay the regular non-resident rate. All access and keep access to the open skate, family skate, and the open hockey. The model that we did for was a 10%, since only Monday through Thursday, and historically the quieter days as well, of the daily fees. So you can see if we had perfect season, met last year, we would be right in line with revenue. The reality will probably be somewhere between there and that kind of base model.
So this summer we did.
Do you mind if I ask a question? I think last year the passes sold out. I couldn't get one. I remember that much. Is there going to be a cap, or will it be higher on pass sales this year?
Great question. Right now, there's no pass limit. Limits on passes. So
we did sell out initially, and we opened up additional passes after the first week or two. Then we opened up additional a couple weeks after that. So anyone who wanted a pass could have got to stay at some point. But because of the tight restrictions we were in, we really were limited by the amount of ice. We significant number of hours of open skate were added last year because of the restrictions. So this year, this model will actually allow us, if we do go backwards, we're hoping we're not going to, will allow us to potentially reserve, you know, limit on the Friday, Saturday, Sunday to pass holders and make it more accessible for them. We don't foresee having a limit on passes this year. So this last summer, we did a cost recovery exercise on what it truly costs for a skater, hockey player, and a renter to use the facility. So we looked at, you know, how much do they pay to visit facilities. So a skater paid $8 for adult team. We're proposing a $12 this year. We looked at the three-year average revenue per visit, so how many dollars are we bringing in per visitor, and that was just under $11. And then we took the overall cost of operating the facility by the amount of usage OpenSkate uses, and it was just under $30 a skater it's costing to a visitor in the door. We did the same thing for hockey. Hockey, it is worth noting that it tends to be the majority of the ice is on the studio. It is limited to 15 on the rink, while the open skate might be 200, 250. And it tends to be at strange times, so 9 o'clock at night on a Tuesday or midday on a Wednesday. So a lot of the times hockey uses what we refer to as dead ice, so there might be, you know, a couple of people out there. But it's not traditionally at times when you have a lot of public skate. But when you do look at our cost recovery model, the cost of operating that one, or getting that one visitor to skate, is just under $48. So again, it is being subsidized by the taxpayer. When you look at the ice rental fees, so this is a group that might rent on an evening, bring in their own private group and pickup games, we increased the fees by 25% last year to $344, and we're proposing increasing them again to $355. When you look at the 3 year average cost an hour, filled in the non-resident rate, it was about $384 an hour. When you looked at a cost recovery basis, the cost per hour was around $440. So this year we don't think it's going to be that high. We think it's probably going to be around the $380 mark if we have a good winter. Well, you can still see that the rentals are still being slightly subsidized by the taxpayer. So we are trying to bring those prices in line so that they are fully recoverable by the user fees.
So our tennis special events, we're bringing back our ever successful family nights. So every Friday throughout the season, we'll have a different theme. Working with Nate, our new special event manager, to add some new elements to these and just add a little more spruce to each of them, really can entice, you know, our pass holders to come out and enjoy those skates. They were super successful last year. Wanting to build upon that community-based activity. As always, special events activities that we have throughout the season, opening day will be the November 22nd, really just open skate and open hockey all day long. Thanksgiving weekend, it, you know, kind of leads nicely into the village's evening light up the tree kind of event, which is nice. Other events we're looking at doing is a night before New Year's Eve event. It's targeting more teens over winter break, and then possibly a New Year's Eve. It's targeting more kind of your preschool to young youth age participants. And always our winter carnival on MLK Day will be kind of a big hit. And that one will be free to the public. You won't have to have a pass to attend that. Other events that we've explored and done in the past are gingerbread houses, possibly a President's Day event, and then Skate with Santa type of events. As far as marketing and communication goes, working closely with Aaron. So we started our process with the Watts Advisory meeting last week. Aaron's began hitting the ground on social media, Google Ads, kind of our standard options as far as marketing really our past in the season. Skating and hockey class will be back. They were super successful last season as well. Consoles are up on the website, viewable. Passes are up on the website, viewable at this moment. Email marketing, we have one, I believe, going out tomorrow. Once we get a final approval on everything, so we'll really hit the ground rolling. Along with a postcard, we'll go out to every resident. And we'll just continue to email and social media and other ads throughout the kind of hits.
Some of these dates are not quite right, but yes.
Yeah, just in general.
Yeah. This is the presentation we gave to the Watts Advisory last Wednesday. So just the feedback we did receive from the advisory was there was two main points Adam mentioned already, was adding a tot skate in the morning for after preschool. And then their recommendation was to, instead of doing 10 guest passes, to offer 5 and be able to offer multiples of 5. So that's feedback we've taken on board. And we're open to the board's feedback on the presentation too, on thoughts.
Well, I didn't make that for the guest passes, and I was wondering if that the motivation for that was just financial incentive to get more money up front with the 10, but I agree. I think that 5 is fair, because I know I've purchased them in the past and I never even used the 5. So I think that would be more fair to residents. You're taking the hacking price way down, so this is like a quick calculation. So last year, that means we sold about 160. So if those same people bought a pass for 60, we'd be at 9,600 rather than 24,000. So it is taking a big hit there, and you guys showed that we do spend more for a hockey player. So I'm just wondering where that came from and if the committee had any feedback on that.
So we didn't get any feedback on that. Last year, it is worth noting, all of the passes we sold to non-residents, the majority of them were because all the other rinks were closed, so they didn't have anywhere else to go. So we don't foresee selling that many passes again, because McGillan's Pond, which is free, most of the time is available, and a lot of the other rinks are now open. So the reason we went down this road was because we're trying to encourage residents to use it more. And in the past, when you look at the past data, pre-COVID, there's very few hockey passes sold.
We only sell about 40 hockey passes, most of them are punch cards, basically daily admission, and a few combo passes for skating and hockey. So it was limited compared to last year, which we sold about 275 in the COVID year, which about 45% were non-residents.
Well, last year was more an anomaly in terms of hockey. Okay, so that makes sense. My other question was, are you going to allow any birthday parties this year? Is that going to be a source of revenue?
Yeah, and I'm working closely with Ann to build a schedule that accommodates birthday parties, kind of building the schedule. We want to kind of hold off and see how many passes we sell. That'll kind of dictate what open ice we have, but I know we're looking right now at a possible studio morning on Sundays from like 9 to 10:30 before we really get busy, since we'll have kind of open hockey. So that, I know that'll be an option, and then we're looking at a couple other time slots to try to, I know people are eager. She's been getting a lot of emails inquiring about rentals, birthday parties, kind of the whole nine yards, being outdoors, so.
Okay, then just one other question. Well, I like the no reservations, for sure. And okay, someone else can chime in, sorry. I'll think of it.
I was going to ask the birthday question too, because frankly, I don't think that there are a lot of options for outdoor birthday parties, and that being taken away last year was challenging. Are you expecting, in terms of class participation, it to be lower? I know Centennial and Highland Park was closed for classes last year, and I remember there were morning sessions and afternoon sessions, and then I tentatively looked at the schedule and looks like it's scaled back. Are we expecting less class participants?
The schedule's somewhat similar to last year. We just switched days from Fridays to Thursdays based off of the part of the ability. Saturdays will be very similar. It might be one class short.
Okay.
One of the nice things we can do is if we have a huge demand, we can add classes on that end. We're also planning on having two classes going on at once after school. So we'll have the skating class on the main rink as part of public skate, and then the hockey class beyond the studio. So we can hopefully hopefully kind of get as many people, and those will be connected to the school as well, so kids from South as well could come over, get walked over, have a snack or put their skates on and start skating.
So the committee had no feedback on the non-resident rate. I mean, that is a big difference from last year.
We had no feedback from them whatsoever. We're not expecting, traditionally we don't get a lot of non-residents. We have definitely seen last year a bump up. I think what we're trying to do is reward residents who buy the pass, especially on those day after Thanksgiving when they got family in town. We want them to be able to bring their guests to the rink. So I think last year was an anomaly and it kind of skews things a little bit. But we think non-residents should pay that double the markup because it is such an expensive facility to operate.
Last year was about 90% of the skating passes were residents out of the 1,800 that we sold. Mm-hmm. So a large bulk of the skating were still residents versus not.
Yeah, given the level of subsidy that the residents have for this particular facility, it does seem to equate to a bigger difference between resident and non-resident rate than other sorts of, you know, programs that we do. So I'm okay with it, and we didn't get any negative feedback at that meeting. Quick question, you didn't mention it, but I know that part of the reasoning behind the single passes that last year there were some issues with hockey players coming on with skating passes because they were less expensive, and it became a policing situation and a management issue, labor issue, everything. I know that's an additional motivation. It's not the only motivation, but probably worth mentioning.
Absolutely, President Brooks, and I would mention it's been a problem ever since I joined the district. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is because it's very hard to police because the rink is open so many hours a day, people have realized you don't need to buy it, and that it's really hard to police, so people stop buying the pass. So it almost, the foundation of the pass was eroded due to the cost of enforcing it. So, again, if somebody is a skater and now is the chance to play hockey, and that's great, or if somebody's a hockey player and wants to public skate with their family, I think the more usage we can get on the rink, I think that's a benefit for the community.
And I will also just chime in and say, do whatever you can to squeeze in birthday parties, because I am absolutely confident we will be able to fill those slots.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely take that away from this meeting and look at some innovative ways to make sure we can squeeze people in.
Something Ann and I are looking at is similar to what we do at the Sun Shelter, is with the rec room, possibly being able to rent that and public skate and have a birthday party in the rec room, and then participate as part of a public skate might be an option. We're kind of exploring as well.
That's a good idea. Yeah. And just very quickly, I want to ask Carol and Stephanie, you've got children, Stephanie, just a little bit out of this age range, Carol right in it. If you have any thoughts on the idea of adding a tot skate during the week, midday, after preschool, before naps. Does that sound like something you think the community would be able to avail themselves of? How does that sound to you?
I mean, frankly, I think the time between preschool, getting out, and nap is pretty hectic, so I don't know how frequently that would be used. I think for two seasons, I've used afternoon and just skipped nap as a parent because that weekday just doesn't work out. I don't recall, does open skate start at 1? I think that kind of works for a number of families, but yeah, I think a lot of the, you know, 3-year-olds are in preschool until at least 11. And under 3, probably not a whole lot of ability, not much ability to skate. So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think it's worth trying at least once, because the committee did ask it. And you know, everyone has different schedules. Some kids are assisting every day, you know. I think there's a range. So it's worth trying to see if it's used. I mean, not scheduling staff six times, just trying it once or twice and seeing how it goes.
Marginal cost is almost nothing for putting it on. So we traditionally have our full-time staff there at that time, and we don't put on attendance. So really, I think it's worth the risk to put it on and have designated times. It might attract some. We've noticed last year especially the lunchtime skate was very busy, obviously with no school. The ELC and GJK families may be interested in a lunchtime skate. So I see no downside.
Good.
I'd also like to note that during the school days, during the week, Watts Indoor Facility will be closed. We partnered with school district, South School, to bring the kids over there for lunch so they can better spread out the kids and maintain the social distancing they need to do. So we would only open the building up late Friday, and throughout the weekend. Other than that, the building will be closed.
Question about the revenue models. And it just looks like a very difficult year to forecast, where it looks like worst case we do the same level we did in 2019-2020. In the best of circumstances, it's you're up to what it was last year. And I guess it, you know, depends on what other facilities are open, and also the different marketing and pricing models we have. And it's maybe unfair, and if it's just too difficult, you feel free to take a pass. But what would you sort of guess as a, if you were going to pick a range for 2 years out, and say, let's say COVID is largely behind us, people are vaccinated, it's under control, are you back sort of somewhere on a trend of 40,000 to 50,000 sort of pricing? Are we just seeing a potential bump here short term? Or, I mean, can you give me, and if you can't, that's fine, but can you give me any insight into what it looks like, for two seasons out?
Sure. So passes have been on the decline in Parks and Rec for probably the last 5 or 10 years. People want the flexibility to turn up. So we saw that with beach passes. We saw that with walk passes before the pandemic. I would say this is a bump, but what we have learned is people want access to special events. They want access to something with their community. So if we do a good enough job making the pass valuable enough and giving them access to what they want, really upping the level of special events, I think we will definitely keep some of the bump. I don't think we're going to do the best case. I think if we were at the base case, I would be delighted. So we have to do a better job, and I think we are doing it, of making the special events and what the place to be. And what we've seen is the more people use something, the more they feel good about spending money on it. So the more we can get that usage up, people will be willing to pay the $60 for the fee. So that's our goal this year, is purely make the pass valuable so that next year they say, wow, what a great experience. I'm going to buy the pass again.
I like that strategy. Thanks, Bobby.
Okay, is there anything more for Bobby, Lisa, and Adam? Okay, good. Then we will move along. And Lisa, you don't need any sort of recommendation or anything from us, do you, or do you?
Nope. We got some input from you, so we're going to go ahead with this model and implement some of your suggestions instead.
Good. It's quite obvious what we were. Okay, very good. So we will move to discussion on 2022 fireworks. Again, Lisa and Bobby will lead the discussion.
All right. So it's funny, when I was putting this on the agenda about a month ago, I asked Bobby, did Bobby go start doing the groundwork to securing fireworks again for next year for July 4th? And I was actually going to bring up to the board a discussion whether we should have the fireworks on July 3rd or July 4th. I know with the board for Carol and Bart had that discussion about 4 years ago, whether we should switch permanently to the 3rd, keep the beach open on the 4th. So then Bobby comes running up to my office and says, oh no, there's a fireworks shortage also, both fireworks and they saw a huge retirement in pyrotechnics, employees through the pandemic. So our Melrose Fire Tactics, who had been gone through, who used for years, way before I was here, no longer had July 3rd or 4th open. We tried to get the 2nd. They're like, I don't think we can guarantee that also. So then Bobby ran to called up a whole bunch of three other providers trying to secure fireworks for that weekend. So we were able to get a quote and from a Mad Bomber, who I'd worked for and worked with in the past, and they had very similar fireworks to Melrose, and as far as quality and safety and experience, and they were able to guarantee July 3rd. So we're able to get July 3rd fireworks. Really, there's not an option for any of the board that we contacted July 4th, so that's not even up for discussion. So staff is recommending that we go with July 3rd fireworks and do similar to what we had for the September show, is we'll do food trucks and music and everything on July 3rd, have a big party. The beach would be closed that day to set up fireworks. Boating, we'll still be able to use the boating side for a little bit. And then do our fireworks and have a great community celebration. And then open the beach on July 4th, which community seemed to really like during the pandemic. If we learned anything, they love having their beach open. And if you recall our survey 4 years ago, it was 50-50 whether they wanted the beach open. I think people really like that opportunity. So we would still do our traditional activities for July morning, the parade, and then we'd be done, or we'd do something for our beach hold pass holders again on the 4th of July. We are kind of going down that same model that we have this year, have the season passes only, goers only on the weekends and holidays. That really drove our season pass sales and made it a special place for our residents to enjoy the beach, which is the goal of the boards. So that's kind of what we're looking at for July 3rd. So I just wanted to give you an update and give you a consensus. There is no option for a barge. I know in the past we've talked about that. Should we or shouldn't we? There's not an option. So barring not having fireworks at all for a 4th July weekend and moving it to a totally different time of the year, that's what staff is recommending. So throw it up for discussion.
I mean, it's a Sunday, which is great because yeah. People will be off, and they probably won't be off that Tuesday. So I think, you know, I don't think that we want to set it for every year because it depends on the day of the week, but I think for this year it's a nice option.
So I will note that Melrose has sold the company and retired, so they are now out of fireworks game. And then all the other vendors I mentioned that said that there would probably be at least a $10,000 premium if we were to do 4th of July in the future if there was a pass. So just what we're hearing in the market.
So this might be a long-term decision we're doing. And it's also the more you consistent you stay, the more easier it is for the community. So, you know, as we talked about before, it's really hard to switch back from 3rd to 4th or 3rd to 4th as far as marketing, getting the word out, and communication. It's better to make a decision and stick with it for at least, you know, 5 to 8 years. So,
yeah, I think people want to know what to expect. And I'm going to speak for Michael here, who you all know has a particular aversion to 4th of July fireworks, whatever day it's on, Independence Day fireworks ever happening the night before school starts. So if we do it on the 3rd, we're guaranteed it will never be the night before school starts because the 4th will always be a holiday. So given that, speaking on behalf of Michael, I would say the 3rd seems like a reasonable time to sort of set and stick with, and it would be really nice not to have to talk about this every single year. Every year we're talking about when we're going to do the fireworks, but I like the 3rd. I don't see any problem with it whatsoever.
I agree. I think that's a great point about school or about work or the next day, but I also think having that beach in the afternoon was a great transition. The festivities are done in the morning. Then what if it's nice to have somewhere to go, some plan to have in the afternoon? And I know I had guests from out of town come to be able to go to the fireworks and, you know, be guests going to the beach with me, and it just made Glencoe very special and unique for that day.
Absolutely. So, unless you have something to add, Bart?
No, those dates sound fine. I agree with the proposal and what's available. I like that.
Wonderful. Then we
excellent.
Okay.
So seeing that, I actually have already signed the contract for July 3rd because I wanted to stick it. And I just figured I would talk myself out of it if you guys said no. But I didn't want to lose it, to be honest with you. So so we are good to go. I was able to, it was under $24,000, so we don't need an action item. I have informed the village of our predicament, and they're all, or the administration was, and they were going to bring it to their board also. So.
Good mind reading, Lisa. Well done. And we will do a discussion on poverty tax levy. Lisa Shepherd and John will, Cutrera, I hope I said that right,
okay,
will lead the discussion.
All right, I'm going to John because, you know, he's become an expert in tax levy in a very short time. So, John?
Yep, sounds good. Thank you, Lisa, and good evening, everybody. So there is a memo in your packet tonight that really lays out the entire levy process in detail. But really the thing to keep in mind here is that, you know, the levy is obviously separate from the budget process, which is going to get really underway later this year. The levy is really our ability to tax, whereas the budget is our ability to ultimately spend those revenues. So property taxes have typically been about 50%, about half of our revenues. COVID shifted that slightly in the previous fiscal year, as there was obviously less program revenue, and COVID certainly continues to be an unknown variable for the district in our current fiscal year. So tax extension is limited to either CPI or 5%, whichever is lower, so the lesser of those two. And that's measured as of 12/31 of the previous year. So for the 2021 levy, we're looking back to the 12/31/20 CPI number, which was at 1.4%. And that's compared to about 2.3% at 12/31/19, which was the number used for the 2020 levy. So basically what that means is that old growth is going to be capped at 1.4% for the 2021 levy. Now, when I say old growth, I mean all of the existing EAV. So it ultimately excludes teardowns, new development, which is often referred to as new growth. And the new growth is separately identified on our final levy report, and most importantly, it's not subject to that cap. So we don't have to worry about that 1.4% CPI for any new growth. Ultimately, we want to make sure we're capturing all the new growth in what we levy for our 2021 request. So the 2021 levy ultimately will fund our fiscal year 23, so 22-23. And we won't really know what the final levy amounts are until June when the county provides the final extension, which is our levy request then adjusted for several other factors, including EAV, assessed value of property, and also reassessments. So the district has always taken a philosophy of fairness in trying to capture all of the new growth in its EAV or in its levy. And the new growth isn't, again, tied to that CPI or 5%. And the reason for that is, you know, if people are building a new home or part of a new development, or they're essentially buying in for the existing resources that have been funded by the taxpayers who have been paying, you know, taxes for several years. So again, the key in the levy is to make sure we're budgeting to the CPI number, to that 1.4%, but we're also leaving enough room to make sure we're capturing all of that new growth. There is a spreadsheet in the packet too that kind of shows where we've been historically with new growth, and for the most part, it has been below 1% for the past several years. I think the high mark for it was 1.15%, maybe in the 2016 timeframe. But, you know, given there is some development possible and some activity with the Hoover estate, we're looking to take more of a conservative approach to make sure that we're capturing all the new growth in this year's EAV and levy. And for that reason, we built in a little over 2.5% for potential new growth in the 2021 levy. Ultimately, last year's new growth number was 0.77%, but again, it's really critical that we capture all of the new growth in the current year levy. So we know that even if we do capture all the new growth, that the county will still put a cap on the levy based on the PICA law that was passed in 1994. So we're proposing here a little over a 4% increase in the operational levy. That certainly doesn't mean that's what we're going to get. Again, the county's going to take in other factors and limit that based on the PICA law. So PDF page 23 of the board packet shows a fund-by-fund detail of what the proposed amount is for the 2021 levy and how that ultimately compares to the final extended levy for 2020. And again, you'll see for the cap funds, we're proposing a little more than a 4% increase. Again, knowing that we can very well likely will be capped at the CPI number of 1.4%. And maybe an additional, 1% or a little more than that based on the new property. So again, tonight we're just looking for consensus on that philosophy for the 2021 levy, and then at the October 19th meeting, we'll ultimately vote on the truth and taxation resolution, which will formally be approved by the board. That truth and taxation hearing is required only if the increase in the non-cap funds is 5%, so we're actually below that number. But even though we're below it, the district still has historically held that hearing, just in an effort of increasing transparency and ensuring that the public has an opportunity to voice their thoughts on the proposed levy. So again, tonight, just asking for consensus on that request, which is an overall increase of 2.16% when factoring in the debt service, and again, a little over 4% increase for the capped operating funds. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
John, a minor point. It's a small dollar amount, but the dollar amount for the property taxes in the memo versus the resolution is a $3,000 difference. And I didn't know if the right number was the $4,973,300 or if it's $4,970,300. But just say, if you would take a look at that and figure out which is the correct number, because the memo is different than the resolution.
Yep, certainly we'll take a look at that. The total extended levy for all funds is $6,288,200, I believe, including debt service and the special rec.
Okay, but I think in I think in the memo, then it's your that number is $3,000 different as well. I think the memo is saying $6,291,000. I don't know. I don't want to make it. It's a minor point, but if we would just reconcile the numbers.
Certainly.
Okay. All right. Thanks, John.
Any other questions? Riveting, I know. Good job, John. That was your first levy report.
Yeah, exciting.
Well done, John.
Very
nicely done. Okay, so now we will move on to the presentation and discussion on the year two and year three capital projects plan, Fund 67-69, and property condition assessment for the district, Fund 65-69-67. Lisa and I will lead that discussion.
All right, tonight is just a little bit of education for all board members, reminder for where we are and presentation. So I'm going to throw it over to Chris.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Lisa. I'm going to share my screen here so I can take everybody through the memos as we kind of talk about them. Can you guys see the memorandum with capital project performance? No, yes?
Yes.
Great. Just a second. So I just wanted to kind of discuss from a high level where we're at this year, what we're committed to next year, and our funding mechanisms and overall planning process. So first up, we have a performance report on our major capital projects this year. This was a goal of ours through the strategic plan to report back to the board each year on where we're at. As you can see, the major projects performed well. I mean, we're 14, 18, and 4% under budget. We're not reporting on the grant projects here today.
Chris, the screen that you want us to see.
What's that?
We have someone jogging on the ocean right now.
Wow, that's a great photo.
I know.
It really is a nice one, but, you know.
All right, let's see what we got here. All right. Can you see it now?
Yes.
Great. So we have the major funds. Like I was saying, we've got the Cock Park, boating access, the South Overlook. So those projects performed well. We've also got the major Fund 65 fund projects. So I'll describe Fund 65 in a little more detail later on in our discussion. The only real outlier this year was the Westport tennis courts. When we created the estimate for the project, we had snow on the courts. And we started the fiscal year and went out to bid for the project, and the court was in worse condition than we'd anticipated, and the numbers came in a little bit higher. So you had $30,000 budgeted for that project, and it did come in under legal bid at $43,000. So on the whole, we had some pretty strong performance this year with COVID and some really good estimates from our consultants. So is there any particular questions about this performance report? Okay, great. So I just wanted to kind of, as an educational piece, and just because there's a lot going on in the last year, discuss our ongoing capital projects. So these are projects that we have moved past the concept phase to actual design, projects that we're committed to doing next fiscal year or the year after that, and projects that are currently considered funded. So we have the crib retaining wall. So for those commissioners who weren't involved in this conversation, this is like the Lincoln log looking wall after the halfway house down to the water plant on the west side of the road. This was identified in an engineering assessment as needing to be replaced. It is worth noting that as we've got further along in the design process, we've started to see some of the costs increase based on what's needed. We have approached the Village of Glencoe to partner on this project, as the village is just in need of that road as we are. So that's the road that they access the water plant with, the road that we access the beach with. So we are looking to partner on this project 50-50. That may push the actual construction into another fiscal year, depending on when the village's budget aligns. But we think it would be worth it to do the project as a shared collective between both municipalities. In addition, the next project is the pier. As the board knows, we talked about the railings in the last meeting. Pier is scheduled to be done in the spring. We are proceeding with that project as well. And then finally, the Watts renovation. So this is kind of the big kahuna out of all of our projects. We're looking at a $4 million plus budget. This is the park grant project. So we are again looking to break ground in the spring here. We've approved the architect. We're currently soliciting for a construction manager. So on the whole, these projects are all proceeding on schedule and on time. So these are really what we would consider our ongoing major capital project. So beyond that, we have some future projects. So these are projects that when we initially issued the non-referendum bond, we had set in the year three of the bond capital project cycle. So it was projects that we talked about, but not really projects that the board had approved and said, yes, we're ready to move forward on. They're really just placeholders, the projects and the budgets. We've talked about this prior, but I know that there's a lot of new folks on the board, so we're going to want to come back and revisit this. A recent addition to this list has been the West Park OSLAD project, which, again, when we applied for the OSLAD grant, we knew that there would be matching funds necessary if we do receive that grant. So tonight we're just looking at a high-level overview. We're really not going to be talking about strategy or how much is available or what projects we need to prioritize. It's more of just a dialogue about what's out there and, you know, what we feel like it needs to be on that back burner but ready to go in about a year or so. So
let's talk a quick question and take a quick thing. I thought we had 50,000 a year.
You know, as we get closer, we've been increasing that number. So in the first year of the three-year plan, it was 50,000, and then it went to 100,000, and then the plan would be to raise that number up as each year went forward. Because we're anticipating that to be about $1 million to $1.5 million project when the time comes. So as the board is aware, we've received very vocal feedback about the condition of the tennis courts at Lakefront Park. In addition, the playground is also close to the end of its useful life. So one of the things that the staff is recommending is that we develop a concept plan for those particular amenities at Lakefront Park. Not necessarily a full park master plan, but something really targeted to address the amenities that we know are at the end of the useful life. And then once we kind of see where our finances come in for next year, where our major capital projects come in after bidding, and, you know, what, if any, funds would be able to be transferred from surpluses this fiscal year, the board could evaluate that plan and decide if they'd like to move forward and replace those existing recreation amenities. So to replace those amenities, we need probably about a six-month lead time to develop a plan, to seek community input, to do all the things necessary to have a successful capital project. So by moving forward with the concept plan now, we can have it on the shelf and ready to go, depending on where our funds turn up. And did I cover that in its entirety, Lisa?
Yes. It's important to remember with that design plan we want to do, you know, plans like that have a shelf life. You know, it's not uncommon for park districts to develop designs for future projects and have them ready to go. We anticipate that that project for the tennis court and the playground will have extensive community input regarding whether it should stay all tennis courts, whether it should move to pickleball court, should be downsized. We just know that from our last discussion in Lakefront Park. So we would have that ongoing community discussion, not just with the neighbors, but with the tennis and pickleball community as a whole. So we anticipate that may take a little bit longer than the traditional process, but we just want to be able to be able to move on that project should we have the funding available to do so to meet the community demands for that.
Thank you. Beyond that, we have the outstanding grant projects. So as I mentioned, West, the OSLAD grant. In addition, we applied for a Illinois Department of Natural Resources beach access grant, or boating beach access grant, for the crib wall, because that road ramp is actually technically considered the ramp access to our boating facility. So if we were to receive that grant, it's an $80,000 grant, and we have a two-year timeline to spend it. So fingers crossed, that can help offset the costs on that project that we're looking to share with the village. So before I move on to the major capital funds and the condition sheets, is there any questions about the existing projects, past projects, anything?
Do you anticipating
are you anticipating that because of supply chain issues, labor shortages, that some of these fiscal 2022 projects might get bumped? And are there some that are that we're anticipating might be reshuffled?
I'm anticipating pursuing the three projects based on the current funds that we have on hand. It is highly likely that we are going to see escalations of costs. The Watts in particular, that project has a finite timeline based on the grant application that we have, so we're really not able to put that one on the back burner for 1 or 2 years based on the $2.5 million grant. The pier itself, the board has expressed interest in getting that project done in the spring, so if any projects were to be put on the back burner, I think for a year it would likely be the crib and retaining wall project, based on waiting for funding from the village.
Yeah, that's what I would say. The crib one is one we probably would we could put off if needed. But the pier, I would not recommend doing that any longer. We've delayed that for a couple of years now because of the design and the pandemic. But and Watts, yeah, we don't want to lose that grant funding, so.
There isn't any particular expectation that pricing, that this is a short, sharp bump in pricing, but that prices falling are kind of sticky. And my guess is it's going to be a while before an adjustment is made. And so there isn't any particular reason to hold off waiting for prices to start going back down again. Is that the general thinking?
Yes and no. I mean, I think we're going into it knowing what the high demand items are. So as we go forward and we design things, we're designing things with a time frame where we're not going to be paying rush charges. charges. We're looking at what materials are appropriate for our selection based on what's also available. So I would agree that, you know, you may take what, where the prices come down to will likely not be pre-pandemic levels at any point.
I was just going to, I mean, those of us who have been on the board and the staff obviously knows that we, you know, this is not our first time talking about Lakeview Park. We do have plans that I assume we're going to at least look at. I know that it was years ago, but the same issues we had years ago are the same issues we have now. So are we going to use that rather than starting over? I assume it'll be we'll try that first, right?
Stephanie, for example, those plans were for the whole park, and we're not recommending advancing the whole plan, and those were kind of conceptual plans, so we're going to look more detail at the tennis court and the playground. And what we found through that whole conceptual place for the whole park, we're only doing a small section of that, is that there was concern about whether we should keep the tennis courts. I think we've found through the years that definitely people want to keep those tennis courts at that location. So what in what configuration then? Do we have pickleball courts, things like that? There's not really a new place to move it. We also discovered that in that lakefront master plan design. It's really without taking out major trees, we really can't move the tennis courts to a different location or the playground for that matter without disturbing great our oak trees in there. So yes, we are using part of that plan, but we're not advancing that whole conceptual plan as far as the entryway, the pathways, and things like that. We just don't have the funds for that right now.
I think
that's why I was confused, because when you said we would plan this for when the funds come available, I know that's my concern, because I don't think we would have the funds for that right now.
No, that's definitely not.
I mean, that was maybe you knew about a donor or something.
That was $1.5 million project, yeah. 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's why I was questioning.
No. So it's only that small portion of replacing our current infrastructure, not adding new infrastructure. So it's only replacing the tennis courts or converting some into pickleball courts. Because I believe we have three tennis courts there, right, Chris?
It's two so, doubles and one single.
There you go. So there's potential to add pickleball if the community wants it. And then the playground, we're not looking at expanding the scope of the playground design, maybe more for safety reasons, but we're not looking to put a huge playground in there. So we'll keep those. Those are more modest amenities.
I think I'm the only commissioner remaining, the only dinosaur still on the planet, who was actually sat through the conceptual plan presentation, and I have some, you know, memories of it. The only thing I would say is we have to keep in mind that a big part of that plan involved entrance and sort of reframing the entrance, and if we do work on the courts and the playground, just to keep in mind that not now, but someday, we would want to revamp that, and I have a feeling it's going to get disruptive with this building anyway, but at some point we'll want to revamp that, and if we do, don't do something that we can't incorporate some of the better ideas from the conceptual plan. And I remember also they were talking about replacing one of the courts with those lumps. Oh, I know that's not the right word, but you know, those lumps that kids climb over, little mini hills. You know, the plan was not embraced by the commissioners, so I think it's appropriate now to move on to the courts and really drill down as to what people want there, redo the playground, although I think you folks from the budget you have set here are thinking not expanding the footprint much of the playground and not doing a much more elaborate playground, just a new one. Is that reasonable?
You know, that Lisa, is correct. I would say that the budget numbers that are there were placeholder numbers.
Okay.
I think that based on the tennis court numbers that we saw in the West Park OSLAD plan and kind of what we've seen, I don't think we're looking at, you know, the numbers that we see on this memo. Those were really placeholders. I think we really have to vet through a whole concept process. I think it's important to note with the original lakefront plan, those very, very interesting park entryways, We did use those at Park Avenue and Veterans Park. So we took
I wondered about that.
So there was a lot of value to that plan. It was really an overarching visioning process.
Cool.
And we never really hammered out an executable plan. And I think that we did get those really great park entryways that we were able to capitalize and use somewhere else in the district. So I do feel like there was a lot of value to that plan, and it just didn't go on the shelf.
I agree. There was value. Exactly. Sometimes the value is not now, and sometimes the value is we'll do part of this. So, that's fine. Lisa, what do you want from us now? Do you want us to just sort of acknowledge agreement that you should move forward with the design?
That is correct. We would like that. And we will keep in mind, Lisa, what you said, because I agree with you. I call it do no harm. Make sure that we plan for the future so that when we're doing these tennis courts, that we keep in mind that old design for those entryways may or may not be a possibility, but we'll keep that. So we don't have to take anything out with those in. So we're looking for a consensus to go ahead and authorize. In my spending authority, it's about $17,000 to $18,000 for those designs. That you guys are in agreement, that's a good idea to move forward.
I just want to know when we'll find out. I know you don't have an exact date, but do we find out this year about West Park Outside Grant? Do we find out next year? Does that affect what's going to happen at Lake Front Park? And it's going to affect community input. So when will we know about that?
We're guessing, Jen, usually they come around conference time, so it's January. We don't know. We have not heard exactly when those are going to come out. But even if we plan this and say we don't get West and we want to advance this one, we still have plenty of time, if we don't find out about it.
Really, even under the best circumstances, it's going to take until April or May to get a signed contract out of the idea. It's very likely a 2023-24 project at West under best case scenario.
So yeah, that's what I need, is that everybody agrees to move on with that. So,
does anyone disagree? That would be a better way. No.
I have one quick question. Presentations were extraordinarily well presented, and there's something I didn't understand. And it's the Fund 65 memo, the third paragraph. It says staff advises not deferring the Red Line project for master plan initiatives. And I was hoping in like 10 seconds or less you could give me an example of what the master plan initiatives might be.
Bart, I haven't gotten those memos yet.
Okay.
But I can answer that question. So what it means is that we have to take care of what we have in buildings, so roofs and flooring and things like that, and not take it away for new initiative, new bigger projects in the parks.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sorry to get ahead there. So.
That's great.
All right, it's exciting stuff. So are we good to move forward, Lisa?
Yeah, you can move to Fund 65, yes.
Correct. Great. So I've outlined for the board, first starting off with Fund 65. So Fund 65 is kind of what we refer to as the Keeping the Lights On Fund. This is a tax-supported fund with an annual transfer of tax receipts in the amount of $500,000. So as Lisa indicated, this is the stuff that is very important to our operation, but really is not fun and exciting. So things like roofs, boilers, pickup trucks. Occasionally we purchase recreation equipment out of it, like sailboats or golf carts, things of that nature. But on the whole, it's really things that we use to keep the lights on at the park district. So we have what we call the condition assessments. So this is a tool that we use internally and also externally, and a tool we use in our guided budgeting process to really get a visual representation. Really, we call them heat sheets, of the condition of the park district large ticket capital items. It can get really easy to get focused on, adding an amenity or getting really excited about one particular thing and not realize, hey, we might actually be spending money we need next year on this project this year. So by going through these condition assessments, we're really able to triage our amenities, how we're able to keep our facilities open and operating with our limited funds. So there are items on these lists that may eventually have to come out of the master plan initiative, but for the most part, this is the tool that we use internally to manage all of our infrastructure that we consider Fund 65 type infrastructure. So
each different facility or different major operation has its own sheet. You can see the ticket center, you can see the boathouse, watch center. It is worth noting that the majority of the items on this list will be corrected within the upcoming renovation, which was already budgeted for. One of my favorites, the parks vehicles, rec vehicles. You can see we do maintain a lot of equipment. We're a very small but mighty team. So this is really just the tool that we use to manage the age of our equipment, the overall condition. And these numbers do change. They are in flux. We do often have to extend the lifespan of a piece of equipment just based on the funds that are allowed. We populate these spreadsheets with an engineering assessment that we had done 5 years ago by a mechanical engineer who was very brilliant but was really not good at conveying data. So we took that engineering assessment and we put it into these heat sheets in a way that would be easy to understand and easy to track. So is there any particular questions about Fund 65 or the heat sheets that go along with that? Okay, great. Then we come to Fund 69 and Fund 67. So Fund 69, to Bart's point, has traditionally funded our master plan capital projects. So our big ticket items, park renovations, facility renovations, the addition of the fitness center, those types of projects. Fund 69 is not tax supported. It is transferred monies are received from surplus fund balances and corporate and recreation funds as available. So the funding amount in this fund is not guaranteed. So as I noted, we really have to triage and prioritize things, and that's where our recommendations to the board are very important. In addition, we have Capital Fund 67. So this is the fund that we use to track the usage of the 2020 non-referendum bond issuance. So when the monies in this fund are gone, they are gone. So that these funds have to be tracked separately from our regular operating surplus based on the rules of the bond, and that's why we have Fund 67. To go along with Fund 69 and 67, we also have our major amenity heat sheet. So this includes our playgrounds, our athletic fields, our racket courts, basketball courts, the Watts facility, the beach house itself. To Stephanie's point, the roof, we have a sinking fund where we set money aside every year for the roof at TAKIF because we know it's going to cost between $1 million and $1.5 million, and we know that that roof is going to be ready for replacement at a certain date. On the whole, we have about $15 to $20 million in deferred maintenance. So one of the biggest ticket items on there is the maintenance center. Again, our facility was built in 1928. Some of the cost estimates on here are from engineering surveys, previous concept plans, work that other districts have done. But for the most part, they're all placeholder numbers. We develop a plan once we move an amenity to the front burner, and then we repopulate this with the appropriate cost estimate. So it's not an exhaustive list of every project that the district's going to do in a 3 or 5 or 10 year period. It's really just putting all the big ticket items in one place so we can triage those as we need. Questions? That's a lot. I went fast.
Is it time to do another tour of the maintenance center, Chris and Lisa? I mean, only because I've been on it, and I don't know if any... Stephanie, have you been on a tour of the maintenance center? Oh, you have too. Okay, good.
I think it's everybody but Bart and Carol, and Chris and I were planning to take those two once we have some time.
Okay.
On a separate tour, some of those facilities. We just need to win the lottery. So I heard Powerball's pretty high right now. So if you all would buy a ticket and then you would donate to us $5 million, we will spend it very wisely. So
one person won it last night in California.
Oh.
One person,
$669 million. Yeah.
Oh.
So that's not going to happen, at least not this round.
Well, if we get a hold of those people, maybe they would donate to it. So. Yes.
I'm sure we talked about this 100 times, and I swear that part of the bond we were going to use for the maintenance.
We were going to use it for our capital infrastructure, and other amenities were higher on the list. So we would need close to $2 to $3 million to do the maintenance center. So we don't, with the Watts building, we just don't have the funds, but we could build up our fund balance again once we get some of these lower items off. It's not off our radar. We're going to, you know, find money.
We did a plan for the maintenance center, a concept plan, and that was a $4 million plan 3 years ago. So, you know, when you're right, when we did the bond issuance, we were holding a $1 million number for kind of more of like a lipstick on a pig type work to get us over the hump. But as we've seen the escalation in Watts and some of the other projects, if we really want to continue to pursue those and leverage the brand, we're going to have to really set that on the back burner, unfortunately. You know, I think the board knows the facility is not in great shape, it's segmented and inefficient, but something that we're just going to have to figure out in the long term. Yeah, that's right, Lisa Brooks, I feel you.
Oh, it's so frightening. I mean, the less than symbol is really alarming.
Yeah, I mean, the only other option is to bundle it with a referendum in the future, and that may be the reality, is bundle it with the other beach repairs.
Yep. So.
TBD.
Yep.
I guess the only
thing... But thank you for keeping it on your radar, because that's not a very, community doesn't see that, but it's definitely needed for our efficiency of our operations and the safety of our staff.
Stephanie, do you recall previous discussions about the Shelton Path? Did we have a consensus that would, I mean, I'm sure we did, it's here, but do you remember, to me that's the one thing that stands out that does not feel as urgent, given that the Green Bay Trail, which is so well done right in that section, is right next to it, and you could easily run, walk down that, and then just cut over at the playground.
Lisa, I think it was more about the standing water, and that just like some of our other parks, that we have a lot of standing water, and makes the park unusable in those areas. Less so about the pathway, which has been underwater, so unusable. So I think it's more about fixing the standing water in the park, which didn't occur this year because we're in a drought. But and then repairing the damage that was done. So I think it's more about that standing water in that park, like many of our parks.
So when you say path, Chris and Lisa, you're saying not just the path, but sort of accommodating the standing water in some fashion, sort of with it in some way.
Lisa, think about the entire park north of the playground, or south of the playground, excuse me.
Yep.
Yeah, so the park basically floods outside the existing drainage system. So we set one of our strategic goals as addressing the drainage in one park per year, and this is kind of where we were ticking that box in the long-term plan. But we really, because we had initially talked about, you know, whether there was a natural solution, you know, whether it was a plant material solution, or if we were better off just coming in and, you know, raising up the topography of the existing path so there was standing water on both sides that you could walk through it, and having the appropriate plantings there so it was pleasant to look at. So Lisa Shepherd, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think we were initially thinking like, you know, massive storm sewers and drain it like Cock Park.
No, we were not. No, okay. It was, and we didn't even go down the road of really discussing what we were going to do there. This is a placeholder for the future when we were going to discuss it and then talk about what end. But Chris is exactly right. It was a strategic initiative to start fixing drainage in a park, picking a park every 2 or 3 years and fixing the drain, the standing water problem in it.
Understood.
Do you think we could start a fund like we have the Thinking Roof Fund and do, you know, have a drainage fund and put things like the next thing we're going to talk about with that property sale and put that money into a drainage fund? We know it's an issue. We talk about it every year. We haven't really moved forward on it, but maybe if we put it away and kind of know that money's there, and then if we have a decision to go and try and start joining, we have some of the money there, so it's not as painful.
We could absolutely do that, take some money for that, but we have been addressing them. So we addressed Cock Park as a standing water issue. We have this Shelton is next one in the plan. The one in Ravine Bluffs Park was addressed with our partnership with the cottage and the historical society that was part of to move the house there. They had fixed the drainage. So we are slowly going going in that direction, so we haven't not done anything. But I totally agree with you. We could do a fund with monies from things like we're going to talk next and putting monies aside. But if you could see, they're big ticket items, and that's why they're included in projects, you know, in our capital projects, future projects.
Yeah, it's like a hard to swallow when you see the number, and there's always going to be other things you want to spend on. So if we have it set aside, I just think it'd be easier to.
Okay. We can work with John on that.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's worth noting that the whole plan is organic, and, you know, it's saying, hey, we thought the Shelton pathway was really important, but, you know, now that the Lakefront Park tennis courts are in the condition X, we know that we're going to need to prioritize those over that other amenity, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, we did the same thing when we decided to prioritize all the infrastructure and prevent the halfway house from sliding down the hill over the tennis courts at Lakefront 3 years ago.
Right, exactly. Yep. And those are hard decisions we have to make.
It's like you're a victim of your own success. You make seven or eight things look really good, and then everybody goes, well, why do those look so good and this doesn't look so good?
Yeah.
Especially when they're at the same park, which is hard.
Yeah.
We've spent, you know, close to $1 million at Lakefront on the bluffs and the halfway house and the beach house, and, you know, all people are talking about the tennis court.
You can't see some of those other infrastructure things we have to do to keep the Lakefront and the beach operational, so.
Any other questions? Okay.
Lisa?
Oh,
Chris, do you have something more?
No, did you want me to leave the memo shared for the property so we could look at the PDFs?
Oh, they have it in there. It's fine. You can keep it up. Okay. So the next one we're talking about is we're advancing property at 310 South Avenue out of executive session into a public discussion regarding the potential sale of this property. So bringing Carol and Bart up to date, we had a resident approach us regarding purchasing this property probably about a year ago, requesting if we would have a consideration. It's always been the park district's stand not really to sell usable park district land, and this property is really not usable. And if you refer to your pack, and you'll see that it's actually the backyard of three different properties ends up being encroached on by different garages. Through the years, we believe that was before the current property owner. There is a berm that separates it from the existing park next to it. It has utility easements under it. It's really not of any recreational value for the park district. So the park district, the board at the time, we have two new ones, advanced it for negotiations with the seller to see how much they would sell the property for them. Chris, I'm going to throw it over to you if I'm about to talk.
So, discussing with the board, we initially had set the price tag at $100,000, and the resident came back and just felt like that was too much for the value of the property. And then we entered into a little bit of a cold war over about 6 months, and eventually settled on a $45,000 offer. Also paying for the park district's legal fees for an amount not to exceed $5,000, which met the initial threshold that the board had settled on at $50,000 for the property. As Lisa notates in her memo, we did consult with a local realtor and set the $30 per square foot value for undevelopable land in Glencoe. This is zoned multifamily, this property, so it's not something that has to go through the plan commission. This is a piece of parcel that is owned by the park district, and if the board so chooses, they can sell it. It does have its own existing PIN number. Well, it does have a 310 South Avenue address. It actually has no frontage on South Avenue. As you can see in the photo, it's effectively a tax-exempt residential backyard.
So if the board chose to sell this land, there is a process we have to go through? Council, the first thing we get to do is at the next board meeting, if you so choose, or in future board meeting, you would have to adopt a resolution by a 4/5 vote describing the property and clearing the land is no longer needed by the park district. At that point, if approved, then we would do a petition in writing to the circuit court and publish it in a newspaper for 10 days, go down to court, a judge would rule whether you're allowed to sell the property or not, and if it's approved, then we could go through the legal process of selling the land. There is a lot of community input on this, and if people choose to be to have any interest in this, I am sure people don't even realize we own that property. So I'm just throwing it back out to the board to see if they're we're interested in continuing this process.
I'm sure you had discussed this before, but how did they even were they even able to build on park district land in the first place?
We don't know. That was way before us, way, way before us. It happens quite a bit that there's some encroachment on park district land, whether prior administrations didn't know they were doing it and just happened they go out there, or maybe there was deals made in the past. We have no idea, but there's definitely garages on this property. There's definitely a berm. There's definitely easements. I don't know if you have any other insight.
We have no written easement to allow those encroachments on our property. So there are other properties that have driveways or landscaping that the board has taken action to give permission to an individual to put that on the property in perpetuity. This is not one of those locations. So as Lisa indicated, frequently, you know, folks put fences on park district property, landscaping that appears to be part of their backyard, those types of things. In the last 7 or 8 years, we've typically taken the stance of asking them to remove it if it's new and not allowing it going forward. But that's not, unfortunately, the historical case over the last 100 or so years.
Because it strikes me as it's not only undevelopable land, but almost they almost owe the district something for using their park property all these years. I don't know how you would value that, but.
Yeah, I don't know how we could go back and get it. I don't think it would stand up in court if we tried to. So, yeah, they've been using that easement area for years.
So,
and like we said, it's not the current, we don't believe it was the current owner that did any of that. So they weren't like, oh, we're going to encroach and now we want to buy it. That was not the case.
Yeah, that's Carol's point is really good, and I like that because it's a good way of looking at it. But there's only a current owner now. Those properties were originally owned by other people. So she's just, or he has just purchased, bought up these properties over time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, originally owned one, and then through the years that they went up for sale, the current owner has bought up those properties. It's for known, I know we talked to the board. If the board chose not to sell this and say they were wanting to use it for some kind of development, it would not, us not selling it would not stop them from doing any kind of other dwelling or new houses or whatever to that property. I think this homeowner just really wants to make it right that they've been on our property this whole time and says we probably should make that a legal change. So. And you could go through the whole legal process of asking them to take down their garages, and that would probably be even more expensive than it would ever be worth, so.
And I'm sure that they probably didn't even know that it was in their property until they wanted to do a plan to build something else, and then they were told that it wasn't
yeah.
their property.
I'm sure that was the case, yeah.
Yeah. Can I just ask you to clarify, because we're still at the 50,000? I'm just clarifying because you say an average of 69 per square foot, and then you're saying the fair price would be $30. So are we still at the same price that we're asking?
So the board directed us to go negotiate starting at 45 plus attorney costs. So that's what we were able to negotiate was 45,000. And it was lower than that. Chris did some great negotiations up to 45 plus. We added plus attorney's costs because you can see it's not an easy thing. You don't just hire a realtor and sell it. We have to go through the court process. I have to go downtown with a lawyer, with our park district attorney, and, you know, testify in front of the judge why we should be able to sell it. So it's not something that's just like, so that's why we put attorney costs, which we estimate will be about $5,000.
So we started the negotiation at $5,000.
Yeah.
We wanted 100 and she wanted to offer 5. So I thought that after 6 months we got 45, it was lots of checks.
Because she knows it's useless space for us, and we have said, but it also brings value to her property. So that's where we're at this point.
Based on the direction from the board.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I'm surprised, but I do think it's a fair price. I'm surprised it's settled, but I do think it's a fair price. Any other input?
I just have a question about how this process plays out, because Chris has put great effort into it, and he had 45, and the board said, we'll go back and cover legal costs. So you got that, and I know it's painful. Lisa hasn't spent time downtown. What I'm curious about for bringing it to a conclusion, and the net proceeds won't even be that big, will we have a purchase agreement in place with the person who is offered to pay the 45, so once it's approved, we get it, I'm curious what could derail it, which I hope doesn't happen, and drag our time commitment out even more. Could someone come in after it's approved by the judge for sale and then bid higher? I mean, what I'm looking at is, are we set for the smoothest possible transition out of this, or are there some potential speed bumps?
We cannot do a purchase agreement until it is declared that we can sell it. So we would not do that until that point. And then we would go to do agreement with the negotiations that we negotiate in good faith. So.
Okay, so there's an announcement, this is going to happen. People can give feedback, don't sell it, whatever. But then it could go to the judge, and then we could just,
at that point, sell it to them, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I just need to know if you would like to advance it for a resolution at the next board meeting.
Do we have some kind of letter of intent or some sort of, you know, agreement of some sort between us before you go to the judge?
No.
No.
We do not. We should not do any of that till we're authorized to sell it.
I mean, letter of intent for them saying that I will.
They want it. No, I would recommend not doing that. She wants to buy it. I don't think that's
anything
for
us. All right.
Stopping her. I got stopped, but then I'm sure.
Got it.
She's as eager as we are. I did call her and explain the whole long process. She's like, oh, okay. So, understands why we want dirty bus now.
Okay,
so, I guess I just need to know if do you want us to advance this?
So, Stephanie?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, about time.
Yeah. Bart?
Yes.
Yes. Carol?
Yes.
And I spoke with Michael earlier today, and he would, if he were here, so I also say yes. So you have what you need, right, Lisa?
That's all I need. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. On to other business. Lisa, do you have something?
I have no other business, nor do we have to go into executive session.
Oh. Okay, very good. If there is nothing else, I entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
You get that, Jenny?
Enthusiastic. Yeah, I like that. Roll call.
Who was it? I'm sorry, who motioned? Who second? Jenny didn't get it. Okay, so Bart and Stephanie.
Yep. Yes. Okay, roll call vote, please.
Member Bourne?
Yes.
Member Povey left at 7:30, Jenny, so you know. Member Schneider?
Yes.
Member Spain?
Yes.
Chair Brooks?
Yes. Meeting adjourned.
Excellent. Thank you so
much. Well done. Thank you.